Today is Thursday, January 27th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Carol Van Dam in Washington. The U.S. gives Russia its written response to its NATO concerns. The top U.S. diplomat says there's no concessions.
There is no change. There will be no change.
Australia says it's ready to boost its liquefied natural gas exports to Europe if Russia freezes its supply.
Australia, the United States, and Qatar together supply about 50% of the world's LNG.
And a U.S. Supreme Court justice prepares to step down. We'll have these stories and more next. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken says the ball is now in Russia's court after the U.S. delivered its written response to Moscow's stated security concerns over NATO and Ukraine. As VOA's senior diplomatic correspondent Cindy Sain reports, Blinken said there will be no concessions on NATO's open-door policy to new members, as Russia has demanded.
As Russia deploys more troops and hardware to Belarus and to its own border with Ukraine, Secretary of State Antony Blinken announced the U.S. has delivered its written response to Moscow as promised.
All told, it sets out a serious diplomatic path forward, should Russia choose it. The document we've delivered includes concerns of the United States and our allies and partners about Russia's actions that undermine security. A principled and pragmatic evaluation of the concerns that Russia has raised, and our own proposals for areas where we may be able to find common ground.
Blinken was asked if there were any concessions to Russia in the document on NATO's open door policy to potential new members, such as Ukraine.
First of all, there is no change. There will be no change.
On Tuesday, President Joe Biden indicated he would be open to sanctioning Russian President Vladimir Putin personally if he invades Ukraine. On Wednesday, Blinken elaborated.
The steps that we will take together, swiftly, will go directly to things that President Putin cares deeply about, including Russia's ability to engage economically and financially, including its ability to develop technology for the sectors that it cares most about, like defense, like high tech. And as the president said, everything is on the table, and I'll leave it at that.
The Kremlin said Wednesday that imposing personal sanctions on Putin would have no effect and would be counterproductive in efforts to lower tensions over Ukraine. But some analysts disagree. They say cutting Moscow off from SWIFT, a high-security network that connects thousands of financial institutions around the world, may be the response Moscow fears the most. Bill Browder is the founder of the Global Magnitsky Campaign.
If Russia is cut from SWIFT, as the Americans did with Iran, it would put Russia back into the Dark Ages economically. And that's a real possibility, and it's something which is being discussed in Washington. And then beyond that, it would be totally reasonable to freeze the assets of Putin's oligarchs, the ones who are holding his money for him, freeze it all over the world.
With Russia announcing new military drills Wednesday in the Rostov region bordering Ukraine, a senior U.S. security official said a Russian invasion would trigger sanctions that would include export restrictions of high-tech U.S. equipment in the artificial intelligence, quantum computing, and aerospace sectors. Cindy Sain, VOA News.
Australia has offered to provide additional liquefied natural gas to Europe should Russia decide to cut off energy supplies as tensions rise over Ukraine. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
As tensions over Ukraine grow between Russia and the West, there are mounting fears that Moscow could reduce or shut down the gas it supplies to Europe. The European Union is already short of gas after the easing of COVID-19 restrictions put huge demands on depleted stocks. The EU depends on Russia for around a third of its gas supplies and could need alternative sources as fears of a Russian invasion of Ukraine escalate. Australia is one of the world's leading producers of liquefied natural gas, or LNG, and is prepared to boost its exports to European countries. Trade Minister Dan Tehan said in a statement Thursday that Australia was ready to support our friends and allies in the current challenging and complex geostrategic environment. Tony Wood is the Energy Programme Director at the Grattan Institute, an Australian research organisation. He told the Australian Broadcasting Corporation that Australia was well placed to help.
Australia, the United States and Qatar together supply about 50% of the world's LNG that is shipped natural gas, whereas what Russia provides obviously is via pipeline. But there is some flexibility there. So what's happening now is that they're looking to see if they can get supplies from elsewhere. The US is trying to coordinate some of that. And some Australian gas has already been used to help supplement the problem at the moment. But of course, it could get worse if the situation in the Ukraine gets worse.
Russia's gas exports to Europe are mostly pumped through pipelines that go through Ukraine or other Eastern European nations. Moscow has insisted that the Ukrainian system was dilapidated and has accused its neighbour of stealing gas. Analysts have said that Russia could be using tensions over Ukraine to promote its plan for a new gas pipeline to Germany that bypasses Poland and Ukraine. The Australian government has also urged its citizens to leave Ukraine immediately as Russian troops gather on the border and the threat of an invasion grows. The government has estimated there are about 1,400 Australians in Ukraine. Foreign Affairs Minister Maurice Payne said Tuesday the advice to leave was a cautious and prudent step because the security situation is unpredictable. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
France is continuing to push for dialogue in the Russia-Ukraine crisis. AP correspondent Karen Chalmers has that story.
French President Emmanuel Macron is following French tradition of taking its own path in international affairs ahead of April's elections. Macron and Russian President Vladimir Putin are due to talk after the French hosted talks between Russian and Ukrainian advisers a few days earlier. The talks were the first face-to-face negotiations since Russia has massed troops near Ukraine in recent weeks. However, France's diplomacy-focused strategy complicates efforts by the US and NATO to show a tough, united front against Russia. Many question whether France's efforts will be enough to deter a Russian invasion of Ukraine. I'm Karen Chamas.
U.S. Liberal Supreme Court Justice Stephen Breyer is heading to the White House Thursday, where he's expected to formally announce his retirement, giving U.S. President Joe Biden the chance to pick his first Supreme Court nominee. The 83-year-old justice has served on the High Court for 27 years. His retirement will not change the High Court's conservative majority. VOA's Carol Castiel asked Michael Waldman, president of the Brennan Center for Justice, his reaction to Breyer's expected retirement.
What's your take on his retirement and the consequences?
Well, it's an important moment. Justice Breyer served on the court for a long time. It comes at a time when the court has changed a lot. It now has a supermajority of very conservative justices, six of them to the three liberals, who are in this term, which began in October and runs till June, likely to take a very dramatic set of moves on issues including abortion rights, on issues including gun ownership, on issues including voting rights, and other things like that. So Breyer's retirement sets up a fight over a Supreme Court nomination in the middle of the most consequential Supreme Court term in decades. Now, replacing him with another liberal will not change the balance of the court, but it is a 50-50 U.S. Senate. And these nomination fights have become very partisan. The Republicans have made clear that very few of them are going to vote for any Democrat. President Joe Biden has said that he wants to appoint a black woman to the Supreme Court. There has never been a black woman on the court. There are some very well-qualified judges and lawyers who people are looking at. We can expect, if Justice Breyer's retirement goes through, that there will be a rapid nomination of someone and an effort to pass her and get her confirmed quickly.
That was Michael Waldman, president of the Brennan Center for Justice. He spoke to my colleague Carol Castiel of VOA's Press Conference USA on Wednesday. North Korea has fired two more ballistic missiles, making January the busiest month ever for North Korean missile launches. We get more from VOA's Bill Gallo in Seoul.
South Korea's military said North Korea launched what appear to be two short-range ballistic missiles early Thursday. They were the 9th and 10th missiles North Korea has fired into the sea this month. Japanese Prime Minister Fumio Kishida on Thursday called the launches very regrettable and a violation of United Nations Security Council resolutions. The U.S. State Department also said the launches pose a threat to the region and the international community. North Korea's missile frenzy appears aimed in part at pressuring the United States during an extended pause in nuclear negotiations. U.S. officials have repeatedly called for North Korea to return to talks, which Pyongyang abandoned in 2019. North Korea has refused, saying the United States should first make military and economic concessions. The North's latest test comes after U.S. President Joe Biden's administration reportedly decided on a new ambassador to South Korea. U.S. and South Korean media report that Philip Goldberg, a career ambassador, has been chosen for the position. Goldberg previously served as a U.S. official responsible for coordinating enforcement of international sanctions against North Korea. The U.S. this month imposed sanctions on five North Koreans it accused of aiding the country's weapons program. Bill Gallo, VOA News, Seoul.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Carol Van Dam. Even as the Omicron COVID-19 variant continues to move across the world, scientists are monitoring a new mutation of Omicron dubbed BA2. The World Health Organization maintains that BA2 is not a variant of concern, meaning there is no current evidence to indicate that the new subvariant will worsen COVID-19 transmission or the severity of illness. U.S. Vice President Kamala Harris is in Honduras to attend the inauguration of Xiomara Castro, the Central American nation's first female president. Castro defeated Nasri Aspera, the mayor of the capital, Tegucigalpa, by a wide margin in last November's election. Her victory ends the 12-year rule of the right-wing National Party, which took power after the military overthrew her husband, former President Manuel Zelaya. The National Party's rule was marred by allegations of widespread corruption, ties to drug traffickers, and widespread poverty. The United Nations chief says millions of people in Afghanistan need to be rescued from their frozen hell. AP correspondent Tim McGuire reports.
UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres tells the Security Council,
Afghanistan is hanging by a thread.
He calls on the council members to find a way to release billions of dollars in frozen assets. Guterres says nearly 9 million Afghans are on the brink of starvation, and half the population faces extreme levels of hunger.
We cannot abandon the people of Afghanistan. They need peace, they need hope, they need help. And they need it now.
The U.S. and other Western nations have frozen the assets because of the brutality the Taliban showed the first time it controlled the country. The U.S. previously agreed to donate more than $300 million in direct aid, the most of any nation. The U.N. Special Representative for Afghanistan says more than $4 billion in humanitarian aid is desperately needed. I'm Tim McGuire.
After the military in Burkina Faso ousted President Roch Kabore and dissolved the government, more than 1,000 people gathered in the capital, Ouagadougou, to celebrate, saying they are tired of extremist violence. In the second part of our conversation, Joseph Siegel, director of research at the Africa Center for Strategic Studies, says those who celebrated are not an accurate reflection of all people in Burkina Faso, and he says the political dynamics in the West African country are complicated, just as they are in other African countries with unstable governments.
Let's keep in mind that these are poor countries with weak states, and so they're vulnerable to any sort of instability and insurgency. And the militantist violence we've seen in Mali and Burkina Faso and to a lesser extent in Niger has been building up over a number of years. These are not powerful groups. They're operating on the peripheries and the border areas, but they've been persistent. They've been exploiting intercommunal differences and playing up the weaknesses of these governments. As you note, these are expansive territories that these governments are trying to protect with limited resources. And as a result, these militant Islamist groups have been able to sustain their violent activity and continue to foment instability. And, you know, this is naturally straining the, you know, political systems in each of these countries. And as a result, you're seeing these convulsive reactions to this threat. And but in the process, we're seeing the installation of governments of military juntas that are not representative of the interest of the population, nor are they necessarily going to be more capable of addressing the security threats, which are going to require sustaining, you know, government engagement in these local areas. There's a lot of different factors involved. The international factor is one element of it. And France, the EU, the G5 Sahel countries have all been part of a response. I think it's widely viewed that they have helped to staunch the flow of this militant Islamist activity. But more needs to be done. And, you know, more needs to be done by the governments. More needs to be done by regional actors. More needs to be done by the international community to try to reverse these threats that we're seeing.
What do you see as the way ahead in Burkina Faso? Do you think that this military junta is going to hold and stay in place?
I think it's too early to say what's going to happen in Burkina Faso. A lot of moving parts. The regional economic community, ECOWAS, has denounced the coup and demanded a return to civilian democratic rule. I think, you know, what is going to be needed is after the restoration of a representative constitutional government, there is going to be the need for more regional security cooperation to help Burkina Faso through this threat.
That was Joseph Siegel, research director at the Africa Center for Strategic Studies. He was speaking with me from Washington on Wednesday. The Atlanta-based Carter Center is making dramatic progress in the eradication of guinea worm disease. VOA's Kane Farabaugh reports if the remaining endemic countries in Africa, Chad, South Sudan, Mali, Ethiopia, and border areas of Cameroon eliminate the parasite completely, it would become the first disease in human history eradicated through prevention and not vaccination.
As he faced the world during a 2015 press conference, grappling with a potentially fatal cancer diagnosis, former U.S. President Jimmy Carter said he had one more goal to fulfill.
I'd like for the last guinea worm to die before I do.
Over 6 years later, Carter, now 97, has battled through brain cancer and other health setbacks to see his Carter Center mark a historic milestone in the fight to rid the world of the once-neglected tropical disease. The global nonprofit began dedicating resources to fighting in 1986.
We are pleased to mention that there are only 14 human cases in the world through the end of 2021, and no log so far in 2022.
That's the lowest number of recorded cases in human history, says Adam Weiss, the director of the Carter Center's Guinea Worm Eradication Program. The milestone places the effort close to being only the second disease ever eradicated.
So every year, more than 3 million people were suffering from guinea worm. And today, to be able to say only 14 human beings on a planet of, what, almost 8 billion people is just remarkable.
Remarkable in part, says Weiss, because the 14 cases in 2021 is also a 48% drop from the previous year, a time when the world has been dealing with the coronavirus pandemic.
The national programs have remained almost entirely operational throughout the pandemic.
Weiss says much of the guinea worm eradication effort in endemic countries isn't staffed by foreign nationals, but instead relies on local villagers and community members to manage prevention efforts at local water sources.
We built a formidable force at the community level. We ensure that we have a program which is anchored within the structure of the community. And we work every day to ensure there is ownership at the community level.
McCoy Lagora is the director of the guinea worm eradication effort with the Ministry of Health in South Sudan, a country that at one point accounted for almost 80% of global infections. The effort to fight guinea worm prevailed over civil war and sporadic unrest in South Sudan, to reach the point of only 4 recorded cases in 2021.
And I want to believe that if we can do it in South Sudan, it can be done everywhere.
Mali, Ethiopia, Chad, and parts of its border area with Cameroon are the last strongholds of guinea worm on the planet. But while the effort has mostly met success, it has also experienced setbacks.
What we've seen in the last 10 years or so is infections occurring in domestic animals. And so we did experience a setback to the global campaign in 2012 when we started to see that occurring.
But only a small number of cases were recorded in animals in 2021, and the fight against the worm seems to be nearing the finish line. As the number of guinea worm cases globally dwindles, President Carter's age advances. And Adam Weiss says everyone involved in the effort would like to see the goal of 0 cases reached soon.
Of course, I would like nothing more than to see it happen in his lifetime. You know, President Carter, as our big boss, but also as our North Star in trying to help keep us focused, it adds a layer of pressure and also a layer of responsibility that we all have.
Kane Fairbaugh, VOA News, Chicago.
Nigerian health authorities say the country's life expectancy is among the worst in the world, with influenza and pneumonia leading causes of death. In Nigeria's Cross River State, severe air pollution is increasing the cases of respiratory diseases, as Timothy Obiezu reports from Port Harcourt, Nigeria.
Before leaving for work each day, Port Harcourt resident David Toluadamu dons his face mask. Toluadamu says it's a measure he has been taking since long before the coronavirus pandemic to filter out the sooty air.
Constantly on a daily basis, year in, year out, we have issues with black suits. We breathe in this harmful substance day in, day out in our sleep, while we walk, when we exercise.
Wearing a face mask is a common practice for many in the oil-rich city, polluted by the activities of illegal oil refineries, flaring gas, and the burning of garbage and tires. The pollution generated by soot escalated in 2016. Health authorities say the soot is increasing respiratory ailments in the state, and that some 23,000 people have been affected in the last 5 years. This month, state authorities began addressing the problem in the affected areas by stopping and criminalizing the illegal refinery practices, says a local government head, Samuel Nwanosike.
If the actions is not affecting our health, who bother? We are the ones here. We are the ones dying. We are the ones feeling pain. I am here every day in Ikwerre local government. Sometimes I open my door, everywhere is turned dark. Meanwhile, it's supposed to be sunshine.
Health authorities say the country's life expectancy of 54 years of age ranks among the 5 lowest in the world. Respiratory illnesses such as influenza and pneumonia are leading causes of death. Globally, almost 300,000 people died from these ailments in 2018, according to the World Health Organization estimates cited by the group World Life Expectancy. River State authorities blame soot pollution for making the problem worse. Since the start of this year, they have cracked down on illegal refinery operators, arresting more than 20 and shutting down many bases. Critics accuse state authorities of not doing enough to curb pollution. Ibiosia Sukubo is a local chief in Port Harcourt.
The government is only interested in the proceeds of the oil and gas, but they are not interested in the people. They are not interested in the environment. It has pulled our youths into the creeks, to the breaking of pipes and creating artisanal refinery, forgetting the additional health hazard and implication. We are just a victim of circumstance.
For now, River State authorities say they will continue their crackdown on illegal refineries while looking for other ways to keep residents safe from the soot. Timothy Obiezu for VOA News, Port Harcourt, Nigeria.
That's all we have for you today. On behalf of Managing Editor Kate Dawson, producer Nadia Taha, and the entire production team, thank you so much for joining us on International Edition. For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm Carol Van Damme in Washington.